We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk Then Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for June 6, 2023. Today, we welcome the Vice President of Care Management at Trinity Health, Mary Beth Pace. She'll report on the acute care environment and why payers and providers just can't seem to agree on inpatient and outpatient services. We'll get the latest coding news from Lori Johnson. Tiffany Ferguson covers the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her TalkBack segment. Now, here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a man whose motto is, be kind, rewind, Chuck Buck.
Thanks, Clark. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 556th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, and good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone.
You know, as you heard Clark Anthony announce, the Vice President of Care Management at Trinity Health, Mary Beth Pace, is on our program this morning. She's going to report on why, in the acute care environment, there seems to be at odds from time to time with payers when it comes to inpatient versus outpatient. Reaction?
Well, or are the payers at odds with us?
Yeah, good. A very interesting take, Erica. And speaking of interesting takes, what are you going to be talking about during your TalkBack segment?
Well, I am still sharing what I got out of the ACTIS National Conference because it was so informative.
Excellent, Erica. And we have much news to report, and so we'll begin this morning with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Hi, Chuck. And today we're going to start talking about where we are with the new Alzheimer's drug. So on Friday, CMS made an announcement on how people can access, I hope I pronounce this, Leqembi, the latest drug to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. The FDA's Peripheral and Central Nervous System Drug Advisory Committee will discuss the results of a confirmatory trial of the SA product Leqembi on June 9th, with a potential decision on traditional approval possible within weeks. Broader Medicare coverage would begin on the same day the FDA grants traditional approval. So a confirmatory trial review, the review of the FDA's peripheral central nervous system drug is a significant event. Confirmatory trials are designed to verify and describe the clinical benefits of the drug. So if Leqembi's confirmatory trial is compelling and statistically significant, it could strongly favor its chances of receiving traditional approval. Potential traditional approval is traditional approval by the FDA is an endorsement of a drug's safety and efficacy. If Leqembi secures traditional approval, it would be a notable milestone not only for Eisai, but also be for the treatment and landscape of the disease it targets. No other drugs in this class have achieved traditional approval yet, indicating a potential novelty and significance of Leqembi's possible approval. And then in terms of Medicare coverage, the decision of CMS to cover the drug would also be crucial for broader medical coverage, would mean making Leqembi accessible to a large number of patients, and that's crucial for patients' uptake and the overall market penetration. Implications on other drugs. The FDA granting traditional approval for Leqembi could open the door to other drugs in this class to receive broader coverage under CMS's current policy, potentially encouraging further development and competition within this therapeutic class. So overall, these developments signify important progress in drug development, regulation, and patient accessibility, and the results of the FDA Advisory Committee's decision, the subsequent potential FDA decision, and the implications of Medicare coverage will all be significant aspects to monitor in the coming weeks. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. It is Tuesday, folks. It's June 6th, and you're listening to the 556th live edition of Tucked In Tuesday. Stand by.
If you're having trouble reporting evaluation and management services, E&M, you're not alone. Learn everything you need to know about E&M coding during an upcoming webcast. This expert-guided webcast will showcase tips for providers to ensure appropriate capture of the work performed for a visit. Comprehensive examples will demonstrate documentation gaps and how to educate providers on the documentation necessary to appropriately assign a level of service. You will gain clarification on answers regarding emergency department and urgent care coding circumstances, as well as a review of how and when it's appropriate to code for E&M in radiology and more. The webcast is June 21st. Register now to attend.
Now's the time for the Talked In Tuesday Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica. And hello to our listeners. The next big thing in the coding world is that we're waiting for the fiscal year ICD-10 CM and PCS codes, which should be published very soon. The codes will be released early so coders and vendors can prepare for October 1st, 2023. In the meantime, review your facility-specific coding guidelines. These guidelines address what your facility coders need to know when coding for your facility. It may replace a collection of post-it notes that your coders have. The benefit of written facility-specific guidelines is consistency among the coders and your collected data. I thought I would take my time this morning to walk through the update process. First, identify all the documentation utilized during your coding process. For example, all documents signed or co-signed by a physician is sort of the basics of where we start. Then you may also add some documentation for coding social determinants health or body mass index. Another area to focus on are the inpatient procedures that are coded. Some areas that coders wonder about include EEGs, CTs or CTAs, MRIs, echocardiograms, PIC lines, midlines, TPN, dialysis, and the list could go on and on. I believe you should code PIC lines because they're part of a quality focus, but midlines are usually inserted by nurses and I don't think need to be coded. But if you have a good reason for picking them up, that's all you need to know, but your coders need to know that as well. A related topic is new technology add-on payments or NTAPs. Have these items been identified for your facility? It is important because you do not want to leave money on the table. The NTAPs are usually triggered by the PCS code. And many times these are PCS codes that coders wouldn't normally assign. For diagnosis coding, there are areas to be addressed, such as family history, personal history, smoking status, allergies, long-term drug use, external cause codes, and status post procedures, such as the person has a history of a total hip replacement or a total knee replacement. If you have a cancer registry, that may be a good reason for wanting to capture family history or personal history of cancer, but you don't care about the other areas of family history or personal history. But again, you need to identify your data needs. Do you need to consider that you're coding for hierarchical condition categories or HCCs? So for your area, what HCs are a focus, and you want to be able to pick up that information. Other topics to consider for your facility guidelines include physician queries, documentation for discharge disposition, an escalation process when there is a disagreement between coding and quality or coding and CDI, the collection of social determinants of health information, and what information needs to be abstracted. The benefit of writing these guidelines, as I said before, is data consistency, but also it eliminates people asking, what do I need to know? What do I need to code? Do I need to code this procedure? So you can maybe eliminate a lot of emails. Back to you, Erica.
I think that's some really good advice. I think it's good to make sure you have consistency and know what's expected. Thanks, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thank you, Erica. And Lori Johnson, thanks again. Here now with the Talked In Tuesday report on the social determinants of health is Tiffany Ferguson. And good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, all. Good morning, Chuck. I wanted to talk today about hospitals becoming a pathway to housing and kind of the adventures of what the reality is. So in my recent hospital travels of working with frontline case management staff, we completed an initial assessment and intervened with a patient that provides one example of the significant issues that hospitals are seeing when it comes to social admissions. The patient was a 47-year-old quadriplegic male admitted with back pain. The patient had a significant trauma approximately 5 years ago in a diving accident that completely turned his life upside down and landed him dependent on family and governmental support. The patient was admitted to the hospital under outpatient with observation services while his back pain was being evaluated. In reviewing the hospitalist H&P, we learned that the patient was hoping to go to skilled care until he could move into his brother's house. That was documented. This is a red flag from a case management standpoint and warranted further investigation with the patient. During our conversation with this likable gentleman, we see his predicament that his one brother, who is a paid caregiver, can no longer easily care for him due to his own age and debility. The patient's other brother is now willing to take him in and care for him, but his home will need significant remodeling to handle the patient's handicap needs. The patient believed that if he got into the hospital, he could either get greater caregiver support or go to skilled nursing while the home repairs were completed. When asking the patient why he believed the hospital would solve this problem, he stated that this is what he remembered his previous rehab physician telling him. This is one example of the systemic issues in our communities, failing to intervene with patients resulting in an unnecessary hospitalization, so their social determinant, most often housing, can be solved in the hospital. Patients are sitting in beds in hospitals across the country as we speak because they are homeless and lack access to supportive shelters, because their home situation is inadequate, or because they require a pathway to long-term nursing care facilities. Time and time again, the hospital has become the answer to these determinants rather than the community social services. Physicians' heartstrings are being pulled with patients being admitted to the hospital because their social situation is not safe, skewing the boundaries and definitions of medical necessity. This is by far the most expensive means to a necessary result to help these individuals, and unfortunately, the payer system does not support the need. In our fee-for-service world, this patient's scenario will likely result in denied days for observation from his managed Medicaid plan. The hospital case manager and physician will then deal with the ethical dilemma of discharging this patient and many others back to their subpar conditions. This topic will continue to be an area of conversation with Medler Media and Dr. Hirsch's upcoming webcast regarding payment and compliance for the outpatient in a bed designation, as well as future webcast topics to discuss social complexities and methods for hospitals to handle these patients. The initial answer is how can we prevent the regular response to go to the hospital, and if the patient arrives, how can we delineate social complexities with unideal determinants from true medical necessity? Back to you, Erica.
I can remember many a time in the emergency department where a patient was sort of unceremoniously dumped in the ED and you were left going, I don't know what to do with them. So I think it is a really big problem and we need to get that sorted out because we got to remember it's patients first.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks, Tiffany. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is the CEO for Phoenix Medical Management. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And Tiffany Ferguson, thank you very much for an outstanding report. Be sure to read her report. It's in today's edition of the ICD-10 Monitor. You're listening to Talk to Tuesday. Stand by, everybody.
What do you do when CMS unloads barrels of new codes in your lap? How do you stay on top of your game as a coding genius? Here's what you do. You subscribe to the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Portal. For an unbelievably low subscription price, you can have access to the superstars of coding, Lorianne Bryant, Laurie Johnson, and Dr. Erica Reamer. You'll have access to more than 40 educational webcasts. Plus, you'll earn CEUs to maintain your credentials. The retail value, more than $5,960. But for a limited time, your subscription is only $35 per webcast, a savings of 75%. Subscribe to the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Portal today.
You know, we're always honored when the Vice President of Care Management at Trinity Health, Mary Beth Pace, is on these broadcasts. And today she reports on a situation that seems to occur often in the acute care environment. And that's when there's a disagreement between the payer on inpatient versus outpatient. And so she asks the question somewhat rhetorically, is there a better way? So Mary Beth, welcome to the program. And please, is there a better way?
Thank you, Chuck. And thank you for having me on Talk 10 Tuesdays. Is this a familiar scenario for you? People come to the emergency department. Some do not even need ED level of care. Some need care and can be discharged, and some need to stay. I want to talk about those that stay and require more care that than they can obtain at their home or at the physician office. That care could still be outpatient in the form of observation, because we just aren't sure what the major issue is yet, or it could be inpatient. Our physicians make that call. The CMS rules are very clear that require a physician's determination, and I quote, based on consideration of complex medical factors documented in the medical record, unquote. The patient is admitted to inpatient, and then the dance begins with obtaining authorization. Patient access verifies the insurance is active, sends the notice of admission. Utilization management follows the contract for the insurance company to run whatever screening tool is required and send communication to the insurance company on reason, need, and the screening tool. And if there's any possibility of a readmission, there is more work on both sides. Have we stopped to think about the work we are doing? Do any of you want to take a time out and think about what we need to accomplish? During the pandemic, many of the insurance companies took their lead from CMS, and since the public health emergency helped us waive some UM processes, the insurance companies helped by waiving prior authorization. I'm here to tell you that that process was well-needed reprieve, and I thank every insurance company that waived those prior auths. I'm not sure, though, what the statistics showed as we emerged from the pandemic. It certainly seems that the insurance companies must have thought that the hospitals were pulling a fast one during that time, because it is now more difficult since about late 2021, early 2022, to obtain the authorization number we need to bill for inpatient level of care. And over the course of the past few years, we've really lost that human touch. While I agree that portals and faxing communication is more efficient, and I know many payers would just really like access to the EMR, there are times when there is a lot of valuable information that is lost in the translation of the written word. And all too often, the conversation and medical decision-making is not considered because it isn't happening. Convenient, yes, for very black and white cases, but those gray cases are the norm, not the exception. And how do we do things differently? I wonder, and I challenge all of us, is it time to change our way of doing business? Should we start meeting over virtual platforms with the insurance companies? For all of the insurance contracts you hold, could you review the criteria for the joint operating committee and include the clinical team to discuss trends you are seeing? And in keeping it all about the care of the patient, is it time to meet virtually with the patient at the bedside when they have a high likelihood for or were recently in a readmission? How many times do we need to walk in the shoes of another? The hospital is doing its job providing care for those that come to seek care. The insurance company is doing its job providing their screening and evaluation of the documentation in the chart to determine how to reimburse the hospital. Where does the patient fit in all of this? What say do they have? How can they become more active in their overall care, both physical and financial, in order to have the best outcomes? I wonder how many hospitals call and talk on a weekly basis with their high volume insurance companies. And I mean really talk, not just about the most recent case that they were denied, but about their goals and outcomes. Partnering to make a better process of what is needed and how to get that in order to pay the hospitals and physicians for what they do. And teach us about some of your programs that are available to your members that might help keep them out of the ED and out of the hospital altogether. The future really depends on us learning to work together.
Thanks, Mary Beth. Who would they actually meet with? Would it be the same people that they would be complaining to if, you know, like for a peer-to-peer kind of a thing? Like, how would they figure out who in the insurance company they would have these sort of ongoing conversations with?
I've been on calls with vice presidents. Their title is vice president of utilization management, but then they tell me they don't have the authority to make the decisions that we're asking for. So great question. And I guess it would be the officers of that insurance company should come to the very first couple meetings to set the tone and set the expectations. And then I believe that the feet on the ground, the managers of care, of utilization management, and the managers of the UM programs on the insurance companies should have those conversations and then bubble up. But it is, since it's time sensitive, it's very frustrating to get on a call with an insurance company only to have them tell me that they don't have the authority to make those decisions. So great question.
Yeah, I would say sometimes that that whole time sensitivity thing is so frustrating because if you, you know, you can't find the right person to send the, you know, the appeals to, you can't find the right person to talk to. By the time you get there, they're like, oops, sorry, you're out of the, you know, it's 60 days and you're out of luck.
Right.
Really frustrating. Thanks, Mary Beth. That was the Vice President of Care Management for Trinity Health, Mary Beth Pace.
Now's the time for a very popular segment here at Talk and Tuesdays called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it is all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. I'm going to continue my exploration of what I learned at ACTIS this week. Tim Brundage and Cheryl Erickson spoke on complications and patient safety indicators. As they noted, it is very unfortunate that the word complication has so many meanings. If a condition develops while a patient is in the hospital, it is a comorbid complication. That is, it's complicating the patient's stay. Some complications are associated with medical misadventure, and those are also referred to as adverse events. The Institute for Healthcare Improvement defines an adverse event as an unintended physical injury, which is caused by or contributed to by medical care and requires monitoring, treatment, prolonged stay, or results in death. Preventable means it could have been avoided, and ameliorable means the severity could have been minimized even if the adverse event was unavoidable. Patient safety indicators, PSIs, address potentially avoidable adverse events, which often occur as a result of surgery or a procedure. They were created to identify systematic differences between providers or hospitals to decrease preventable errors. Tim and Cheryl mentioned how postoperative means a temporal period to clinicians and indicates a complication of a procedure to a coder. They discussed different specific PSIs and pointed out opportunities. For instance, was that postoperative sepsis really present prior to the procedure? And is it an opportunity to clarify present on admission, POA, status? Another example of an opportunity is ensuring that only mechanical ventilation that exceeds what is routine for the procedure is captured. If the duration of ventilator support is typical for that surgical recovery, post-procedural respiratory failure should not be diagnosed, and the intubation and ventilation are not coded or billed for separately. I was tickled to see that they used a graphic, which I made, trying to sort out normal postoperative course from acute post-procedural respiratory failure from acute postoperative pulmonary insufficiency. You can see it in my article in ICD-10 monitor. If you can sort out what is normal postoperative recovery and florid acute post-procedural respiratory failure, what lives in the gray zone constitutes acute pulmonary insufficiency, which is a bit of a made-up CDI condition. Speaking of respiratory failure, the next session I attended dealt with newborn respiratory failure. In fact, the innovation and expansion track was chock full of pediatric topics. Newborn respiratory conditions consist of respiratory distress syndrome, transient tachypnea of the newborn TTN, and respiratory failure. The speakers talked about delayed transition of the newborn, which derives from changing over from the womb to air breathing. Neonates can have retractions and need some supplemental oxygen support, but within a very short period of time, they make the transition and it resolves. This is considered part of the birthing process, really, and not coded as pathological. The other conditions are distinguished by onset, duration, severity, and treatment needed. They also discussed the difference between having meconium staining or passage and having meconium aspiration syndrome with respiratory symptoms. Since ACTIS and the American College of Physician Advisors are collaborating to create pediatric CDI materials, and respiratory conditions is the first topic we are tackling, I was really happy to attend this one. The other pediatric CDI talks I attended dealt with sepsis, jaundice, and general CDI. I found it quite interesting that one of the facilities used Medicare severity diagnosis-related groups, MSDRGs, in pediatrics. It is much more common to use all patient refined or APRDRGs. I learned that herpes simplex viral infections, HSV, are increasing in incidence, and there are three distinct types: skin eye mucosa, which they abbreviate as SEM, central nervous system, CNS, and disseminated HSV infections. There have been some changes to the sepsis febrile infant practice since my clinical days. The oldest subgroup, 22 to 28 day olds, are carved out and approached a little differently than the younger cohort. And inflammatory markers help to determine whether a lumbar puncture is needed or not. The antibiotic coverage has changed and discharges are more rapid. In the general PEDS talk, they identified the most commonly missed comorbidities as respiratory conditions, AKI, acidosis, malnutrition, and acute heart failure. They reviewed some diagnoses which increase severity of illness, risk of mortality, like hypocalcemia and hypovolemia and hemorrhagic shock. Finally, they went over the need for developing policies and procedures. Next week, I am going to address one more session in depth. You are not going to want to miss this one. Stay tuned, and back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica. We will stay tuned. That's an excellent topic for your talkback segment. Erica, any comments as we wrap up our program?
I would actually say that we had a couple of comments about who to approach in the payers. One person, Kathy, suggested starting with the medical director at the health plan. And then somebody else said that they meet quarterly in a joint meeting with their biggest payers that's attended by their regional medical directors. And so I think those are really good people to start with. And I also wanted to make one more comment. Lori had mentioned determining what things you really wanted to make sure you were focusing in on coding. And she was talking about HCCs. And I just wanted to say that I just did sort of a deep dive into HCCs, the hierarchical condition categories. And I want to say that there are some big changes that are proposed for 2024 that I will eventually do a talk back on and go over. So stay tuned for that, too.
Thanks, Erica, very much. And thank you all very much for being on our program today. And that is going to be a wrap for this, our 556th live edition of Talking Tuesday. And I want to thank our panelists today, Stephanie Ferguson, Lori Johnson, Tim Powell, Mary Beth Pace, who reported our lead story. And a very special thank you to Dr. Erica Reamer, my co-host. And remember, folks, if you can't listen to us live, you can listen to us on Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. And when you do, give us a review, rate us. Until next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Talk to Tuesday. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great day.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.